Thanks for coming. So this is a little primer. I'm sure all of you know most of this already, but Korea was, of course, divided at the end of the Korean War in the early 1950s. And the dynasty created by Kim Il-sung in Pyongyang, North Korea, has thrived while the country itself has sort of withered in the last 70 years or so. While South Korea has built a thriving democracy and one of the strongest economies, not just in Asia, but in the world. The United States, of course, is the important ally of South Korea. And in the past, Russia and China, in the Cold War era, was the primary ally of the North Korean regime. In recent years, relations between North Korea, Russia, and China have become strained, although just in the last day or two, or the last week or two, Kim Jong-un has apparently reached out to China, and there's a thaw going on there. The real problem and the thorny issue with North Korea is that they have built an enormous arsenal. They have a very powerful military. They have most significantly for the region and for the United States, developed nuclear weapons. They've exploded nuclear bombs. And they've been working avidly toward building an intercontinental ballistic missile, which would mean they would have the capacity of delivering potentially a nuclear weapon or a chemical or biological weapon beyond the region itself all the way to the United States. And American presidents, going back to Nixon, have been vowing to prevent this from happening. Back in the Clinton era, it was a vow to prevent North Korea from developing a nuclear weapon. They exploded their first nuclear weapon, I think it was when Clinton was still president, or maybe when Bush was president. They've exploded five or six more since. And they've been testing nuclear missiles, or rather ICBMs, with increasing range in recent years. President Trump, shortly after being elected, vowed via Twitter that North Korea would not be allowed to build these weapons, which, you know, essentially, at least publicly, brought to a head the dilemma faced by the United States. And the dilemma, framed succinctly, is that North Korea possesses nuclear arms, chemical, biological weapons, and the capacity to essentially destroy the city of Seoul, which is the capital of South Korea. Some 25, 26 million people live in the area around Seoul. So any military action against North Korea risks, at least in the first 48 hours or so, the destruction of Seoul. And this has been a check on any sort of military solution to the problem of North Korea for a long time, and is one of the reasons why North Korea wants these weapons, and secondly, why the United States, with all of the power at its disposal, has really been unable to do anything about this. So that's where we stand.
Great. Thanks for that that setup, Mark. You said a bunch of things I wouldn't have thought of to mention. So I wanted to start out by mentioning that so we're in this kind of building crisis now, but the fact is that we've seen this movie before. So I want to tell you what happened the last time we saw this movie, because it's got all kinds of lessons in it, which I hope somebody on President Trump's staff is trying to explain to him. In 1985, North Korea signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, pledging never ever to get nuclear weapons. Unsurprisingly, they immediately started dragging their feet on carrying out all the obligations, especially with regard to allowing access to inspectors to make sure that they weren't cheating. So this dragged on kind of through the years of the first President Bush. But early in the Clinton administration, it became a bigger and bigger issue. And President Clinton, in fact, started threatening to use military force against North Korea, recognizing, you know, the horrendous strategic situation that existed. It was true then that North Korea could essentially destroy Seoul. And even then, they had a vast arsenal of chemical weapons, including nerve gases of all kinds. And nevertheless, President Clinton was threatening to use military force to stop North Korea from getting nuclear weapons. The last minute, former President Jimmy Carter flew to Pyongyang, talked to the current President Kim's father, Kim Jong-il, and kind of opened the door to a negotiated settlement, which was signed the next year. So in 1994, they signed something called the Agreed Framework, which was basically a giant bribe. The U.S. And Japan and South Korea agreed to provide huge amounts of fuel oil to North Korea in exchange for them shelving the nuclear reactor that they were starting to build, which would have been able to produce large amounts of plutonium, which you can use to build a nuclear weapon. At first, that deal was carried out. North Korea did, in fact, shelve their nuclear reactor project. They started getting their fuel oil. But then they started testing missiles, right? Exactly the same kind of routine that we're seeing now. First a nuclear weapons test, then a missile test. So the missile program became part of the negotiating process. The story is that just as the Clinton administration was ending in December of 2000, they were supposedly very close to a comprehensive deal, but not close enough that President Clinton was willing to commit to actually going to Pyongyang to sign anything. It wasn't quite ready. So he handed the ball off to President Bush, who immediately said, I don't trust the North Koreans. I'm not sure they're carrying out their side of the deal. After which, North Korea stopped carrying out their side of the deal. And so within a couple of years after President Bush taking office, North Korea had, in fact, expanded its testing of missiles and started testing nuclear weapons. So they became a nuclear weapons state as a result of President Bush's hard line. So that's how effective the hard line was. So that's where we're coming from. And we, you know, there's a long history of, on the one hand, North Korea is willing to talk. They sometimes carry out their agreement, but they're also very capable of lying, cheating, and doing the exact opposite of what one is trying to get them to do. And especially likely to do so the harder they're pushed.
Okay. Obviously, what the piece I wrote for The Atlantic, which is why Deborah invited me here, is ran last summer. And it was in response, really, to this challenge that President Trump had made, saying that he would not allow North Korea to build a nuclear-tipped ICBM. And so what I did was I talked to people who had commanded troops in that region of the world. I went and spoke to people from South Korea. I spoke to people who had worked on this issue in the State Department and in the Pentagon, and academics who had studied this issue to find out what exactly were our military options. And I outlined, I think, four of them. But in order not to go through all four, I thought I would can summarize best by choosing what would be theoretically the best case scenario, militarily. We're talking about military options here. The best case scenario, it would seem to me, would be that we could somehow attack North Korea and Pyongyang, wipe out their nuclear weapons program, defeat them, destroy the regime without them getting off a single shot, basically. We could achieve such incredible surprise that we could wipe out the threat without them delivering anything, which is any, no respectable military-minded person believes that this is even possible. But let's assume that it is, just for argument's sake. This is the best case scenario. We wipe out the Kim Jong-un regime, we destroy their arsenals, we defeat their military. What are we left with? We're left with the largest humanitarian tragedy in modern times. We have the entire country of North Korea without an economy, without a government. I would imagine, given the nature of the weapons involved, that North Korea has nuclear, chemical, biological weapons, there would be a considerable amount of irradiation or contamination in North Korea. It would be leaderless. Someone would have to step in to take control of the situation, or the whole situation in North Korea would descend into chaos. Now, I'll give you 2 seconds to imagine who it was, who it would be that the world would turn to step in, especially if the United States precipitated the attack and wiped out the regime in Pyongyang. So the United States would be saddled, to answer my question, with the responsibility for essentially trying to govern this North Korea. If you thought Iraq was difficult to govern after Saddam Hussein was toppled, imagine a North Korea where people are starving, where there's irradiation. It's a very forbidding country in terms of terrain. It's very mountainous. You would have pockets, no doubt, of loyalists to the Kim dynasty, or who knows what else, scattered throughout the country, in possession of weapons and possibly in possession of chemical, biological weapons, or even a dirty nuclear bomb. So sending American troops over to manage the situation in North Korea would be an order of magnitude greater than anything we've ever attempted in our history. Not to mention that this is all taking place next door to China, which would be not particularly thrilled with the idea of the United States moving in to North Korea, right? So, and this is, I remind you, the best case scenario militarily. All the other cases, in fact, any realistic estimate of what would happen, even though the United States and South Korea are overwhelmingly more powerful militarily than North Korea and could readily defeat their forces, to do so before North Korea could exact an unthinkable cost is virtually impossible. And the big reason for that, as I mentioned, is Seoul. Because even if they were unable to use any of their weapons of mass destruction, North Korea has amassed along the demilitarized zone, just north of the border, sufficient artillery to essentially level the city of Seoul within like about 24, 48 hours. This is conventional artillery. So any military strike on North Korea risks an unconscionable loss of human life. And as I said, even the very best case scenario risks a problem that we would definitely not want to have.
So I want to pick up on what Mark was saying and take my usual role of being, I guess, not Mr., but Dr. Doom and Gloom, and pointing out why even the less optimistic scenario is way too optimistic. North Korea's national security strategy is deterrence. They know that in an all-out war, the United States, together with South Korea, could defeat them. So their strategy is based on creating a situation where the cost of the U.S. trying to do so would be so high that it's not worth it. And by any rational calculation, they have succeeded in setting up that situation. Because in addition to the conventional artillery aimed at Seoul, you have to figure on their short-term missiles armed with chemical weapons. Those are just kind of normal routine parts of the North Korean arsenal. They also have special forces units that are specifically trained also to deliver conventional or chemical weapons throughout South Korea. So, you know, if the, from my perspective, the most optimistic possible scenario, if the United States tries to start this sort of let's bomb North Korea and get rid of their nuclear weapons sort of strategy, is that the North Koreans immediately respond with missiles armed with chemical weapons aimed at American military facilities in South Korea and Japan, possibly also South Korean and Japanese cities. And the purpose of doing that wouldn't even be the military destruction. It would be to send the message, we could have put nukes on these, and we didn't. So stop or else. That's the best case scenario, right? The worst case scenario is, remember, the reason they have this strategy of deterrence is because they have excellent reason for their paranoia. Are they clinically paranoid? Absolutely. But they have got good reason. We take it as just sort of ordinary background noise when some American politician says regime change in North Korea would be a nice thing, right? Well, if you're sitting in North Korea, that sounds like a threat. And in fact, that's the way it's meant. And that's the way everybody in the United States thinks about it. Yeah, it would be great if we could get rid of the regime in North Korea. They're crazy. They're scary. So the worst case scenario comes if the North Koreans think that whatever the U.S. is doing is actually the first step towards regime change. Because once they think that's going on, they have no reason for restraint. Remember, I said the restrained version could be you use chemical weapons as a signal that it could have been nuclear, right? If you think the Americans are going to take away all your weapons and then wipe out your regime, you're in a situation of use them or lose them, and they might use them.
And you have to consider that the entire rationale for the Kim dynasty is that the Kim family is capable of protecting North Korea from this inevitable onslaught. And every lesson that every child in North Korea has learned in school from the earliest years is that they're about to be attacked and that they have enemies, the United States premier among them, who are ready to invade at any moment. And that's why, or at least that drives the sort of propaganda of the regime in Pyongyang, and why every threatening move that the United States makes feeds the narrative, essentially, for the Kim dynasty.
Okay, questions? And you can ask, are we all going to die?
Okay, if we start off with the fact that we have no ambassador representation with South Korea, which is would be the recipient of any war. The one of the things not mentioned is if there are troop movements in the last Korean War, which I remember, many people here probably weren't born then, the Chinese did not like our moving troops into North Korea. And if we move troops into North Korea, they will move troops into the north of North Korea. So that that's a dimension that's very troubling.
Yeah, and the question was, what China would do in response to the United States sending troops into North Korea. And as we know from the Korean War, they entered the Korean War. We ended up at war with China. This is something that I think we would definitely like to avoid, and is one of the reasons why the best case scenario is such a dreadful one. The headline writers at The Atlantic put the headline on my story, called it the worst problem on Earth. And I think that kind of sums it up.
Howard, I agree with the premise of your question. Mark was saying this is the best case scenario, that the U.S. just kind of goes in and cleans up North Korea after this catastrophic war. But the Chinese have been pretty clear that their position is that, they were worried that Kim Jong-un's a little crazy too. And so they said very clearly, if North Korea starts a war, they are not going to save Kim Jong-un's bacon. But if the U.S. starts the war, then the alliance that they have with North Korea is still good. So if the U.S. does start bombing North Korea, and in this best case scenario causes the collapse of the regime, the Chinese would be looking at a nightmare situation geostrategically as well as in a humanitarian sense. And so the chances, I think the chances that they would end up sending in troops themselves would be very high. So you have to take that piece of it into account. And this time, of course, China would be a lot more technologically sophisticated than they were in 1950. So that's another whole dimension that we've only touched on a little bit. We talked about how the fighting could extend to Japan, but it could also draw in China as well, and then it becomes a whole new dimension of nightmare.
I have a question here for you. Thank you for your talk. A couple things. First things, should we say that this is a Trump success, his kind of fire and fury rhetoric? Has seemingly opened a door for talks. And second thing, is this something that, I want to see you guys mix things up a bit. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? What does the U.S. Stand to gain or lose from talks with North Korea?
Do you want to start, sir?
Thanks for the question, Justin. Justin is one of my students in political science. I didn't set him up with this, but we might as well have, because this is actually the discussion we wanted to have. So again, I'll be Dr. Doom. It seems to me that in principle, the idea that you make threats in order to get the other side to the table and then negotiate a deal. Sounds like a good strategy. It's just that nothing about the details in this case are likely to work out well. First of all, nobody has ever given up an existing nuclear arsenal in the kind of circumstances that the U.S. is asking North Korea to do so. So I think the chances that they would give up their nuclear arsenal, no matter what kind of threats are leveled at them, are approximately zero. So I think the best that we can do is the situation as it exists right now, which is that North Korea has announced a moratorium on any new tests, which would mean that the intercontinental ballistic missile, the one that could reach the U.S., would remain not fully tested. That's about the best we can do, but that's where we are now. On the idea of a summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, I would suggest that we've seen that movie before, too. What happens when you have a summit meeting between adversaries that's organized on short notice without years of preparatory negotiations is usually bad news. The most famous example would be when President Kennedy met with Premier Khrushchev of the Soviet Union in 1961, and that went so well, the result was the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. When Reagan tried it with Gorbachev, who was, a much different kind of critter, at Reykjavik in 1986, that blew up too. And it took him a year to put things back together again, even though both were actually very sincere about trying to improve relations. So the probability is, and of course you also have to take into account that the new National Security Advisor, Mr. Bolton, has very clearly stated what his proposed strategy would be in a summit meeting with Kim Jong-un, which would be to tell President Trump, to tell President Kim, okay, hand over all of your weapons now or we start bombing. And then when they say no, we start bombing. So, as I've already suggested, that's we know the answer to that is going to be no. So if President Trump takes his National Security Advisor's advice, then the likely result of a summit will be a disastrous failure, which forces Trump to either humiliatingly retreat or start a war. So that's my answer to Mark's why the hell not, right? I think that's why the hell not. It could make things really worse.
Okay, and I don't disagree with much of what Stuart just said. It certainly could make things a lot worse. But I think in the context of a situation where the leader of the United States and the leader of North Korea have been exchanging insults and threats, given the stakes, the idea that they would somehow talk would seem to me to be a step in the right direction. I don't expect anything good to come of it, other than the fact that it itself is a hopeful sign. As far as whether somehow Trump has engineered this by his boisterous threatening behavior toward North Korea, I think is laughable. In fact, I think if you look at what North Korea has been doing very carefully for a long time, it fits with their own plan very neatly. The reason that they wanted a nuclear arsenal, the reason that they wanted a nuclear-tipped ICBM is to force the United States to negotiate with them directly. And that's something that most administrations have been avoiding doing. In fact, President Obama's whole theory of dealing with North Korea was to sort of break the cycle of sort of threats and, you know, what does he call it, the charm threat cycle, where Pyongyang would go through a period where they would, you know, shoot down or blow up a South Korean ship and kill a bunch of sailors or shell an island off the coast of South Korea, and then they would come back from the edge of a potential conflict and become very open to negotiation. We've seen Kim Jong-un, the new leader of North Korea, carefully build his arsenal and demonstrate publicly the reach of these missiles over the last 5 or 6 years, to the point where it's fairly convincing now that he could send a weapon all the way to the United States. And just when he reaches this point, he begins to step back. During the Olympics, he made a couple gestures toward South Korea. He took a trip to China and has tried to thaw a relationship with China. So I think that we're back in the charm threat cycle, and that this is very much something that's being orchestrated by Pyongyang rather than Washington.
One last point. Mark mentioned something that I think is really important. That Kim Jong-un's got a strategy. He's got a plan. The stereotype that he's just completely bonkers is wrong. He's very, very rational. North Korea has played the same game very well for 40 years, a game of deterrence, of making threats for the purpose of safeguarding their own security, their own independence. And they've walked that line very successfully for a long time. You don't do that by luck, and you don't do that by being crazy. You do that by being very smart. The best of the good news to me is that, you know, Kim Jong-un is entirely rational. He wants to continue to breathe, and he wants to continue to rule. So he doesn't want to start a war. He just wants to force the U.S. to accept him.
Okay, thank you. You've made a really good case that it's a very dangerous situation, and that what we need is folks who are very sophisticated and careful and measured in dealing with the situation. And thirdly, that, you know, that's not really available right now. But in getting to that place, how much would it help, or is it at all relevant, you know, for Americans to know just how devastating and vicious the war against North Korea was? I mean, sure, we're not arguing whether or not, you know, whether North Korea is vile and aggressive. We're only saying that they were utterly destroyed. Virtually every building was destroyed. We had so few targets left that we started attacking dams. The difference between civilians and military was erased in this insane kind of anti-communist fever that obtained at that time in our country's history. So how useful would it be for us to take that into consideration?
Well, I've been doing my best to let people know how devastating any kind of military action in Korea would be. And as you point out, I mean, the Korean War in the 1950s was horrible and very costly in human life and devastating to both South Korea and North Korea. Add to that dynamic nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and you have a conflict that literally could have more casualties than any in all of human history. You could outstrip World War II in a conflict on the Korean Peninsula, given the terrible nature of these weapons. So, you know, I hope, and one of the things that heartened me was that when Steve Bannon left the White House, and I'm no big fan of Steve Bannon's, but he said there's no military option in Korea, which says to me that anybody who's given this even the slightest amount of thought, wherever they're coming from on the political spectrum, realizes how disastrous that would be. And, you know, to be honest, and we've been talking about doom and gloom scenarios here, I'm kind of optimistic about the whole thing, actually, because I think that the consequences are so extreme. The same logic that applied during the Cold War, during the whole strategy of mutually assured destruction, certainly is in play here, except in the case of North Korea, it isn't even mutually assured destruction. It's just assured destruction, you know, with terrible casualties, you know, on the South Korean and possibly American side. So I really think it's unlikely, to be honest, that Kim Jong-un would trigger a conflict of any kind. I think, as Stuart has pointed out, he's not a stupid or suicidal person. It's contrary to his own interests. So, you know, I'm actually a little more worried about Trump.
Yeah, I agree completely, which, you know, I think, which gets back to your point. I think part of it is, you know, people do forget what happened in the Korean War. And forget, too, that the Korean War was just a few years after World War II, when leveling entire enemy cities was considered entirely normal, even before, you know, the atomic bombs, right? Just with incendiary bombs, basically napalm. I mean, we forget that. We napalmed entire cities during World War II. I was told by one of my former students, who was an Air Force officer, that that every year at the Air War College, they do a mock trial of the American Air Corps general who was in charge of the bombing of Dresden was actually done by the Brits, but of Germany.
Curtis LeMay?
No, it's not LeMay in Japan. Interestingly, it's Tui Spats, who was doing similar stuff in, you know, to Germany. And every year he's accused of crimes against, he's convicted by the mock jury of crimes against humanity. Right. So 1950 was, you know, was, the early 50s was a different time when it was considered perfectly normal to, you know, level cities. You know, right now that would be horrifying in a way that it wasn't then. But with weapons of mass destruction on the table, it's more likely to happen. You know, frankly, what I've been struggling with is, I honestly believe that this is the kind of issue where people need to stand up and start telling their represented leaders. I mean, it's supposed to be more of an academic kind of talk, but, you know, we need to tell our congressmen, we need to tell our president, we don't want a war. Do not start a war. If Trump doesn't start one, there won't be one. And the consequences of the peace will be okay, precisely because Kim Jong-un is rational enough to be deterred. Doesn't matter what weapons he has, he won't use them because he wants to live. You know, the trick is not to provoke him into using them by attacking.
It's just an armistice. It's not a treaty, what's going on there right now. And it seems to me our own country does not want peace to occur with our 45,000 troops stationed there, and they do not want the reunification of the Koreas. And I've been to very several forums on with South Koreans and North Koreans trying to break down that and get the U.S. out of there so they can come to a peace and get along with their together as one country. So I think this whole dynamic of us sitting here talking about all we're at with the United States is really leaving out the people who actually live there, that they deserve to have their own forms of seeking democracy, wherever it is that they want, whether it's communist, socialist, or whatever it is. They can do it if we allow them. And this is what I'm finding out, that This country, our country, does not want to make peace with those people. That's my comment.
Well, I don't agree with you. I do think that, of course, one of the huge factors in dealing with this issue is how the South Korean government feels about it. And lately, the South Korean government has been a force toward developing talks to move toward reunification. Having been to South Korea a number of times and talked to a lot of people who are in power there, I know that, in fact, South Korea is not eager anytime soon to reunify with North Korea, if only because South Korea is a very successful, booming economy, and it would be a devastating blow to them to have to take on the responsibility for the struggling North Korea. Anyone who's seen that famous photograph of the Korean Peninsula at night, which shows you can actually see the line of the parallel, but and everything south of it is lit up with civilization, and everything north of it is as dark as a black hole. I mean, there is no thriving economy in North Korea. So actually, I think South Korea is very reluctant, although they do want to avoid, obviously, conflict. The presence of American troops in South Korea has prevented, at least for many decades, any military action by North Korea against South Korea. And I think one of the things, frankly, that Kim Jong-un hopes to accomplish by building this nuclear arsenal, by entering into these talks with the United States, is to get the United States off of the peninsula. Because if he does, this gives him tremendous leverage that he doesn't have right now because of the presence of American forces.
I would add that agreeing with Mark, the new president of South Korea, President Moon, has really made an effort to reach out to North Korea. I think it's certainly true that both the South Koreans and the United States want peace, not necessarily unification, but peace. And the problem has always been the North Korean insistence, essentially, that they are the only legitimate government in North Korea, on the Korean Peninsula. Right? So they've been unwilling to do what East Germany did and said, okay, fine, let's agree that at least for now, there's two Germanys, right? They're not willing to agree that, okay, at least for now, there's two legitimate Koreas. If there's a positive outcome, eventually that's the end game, is just recognizing, all right, fine. Let's just say there's two Koreas. There's no need for a war. North Korea can do its thing. South Korea can do its thing. The United States can make very clear, we won't attack if you don't. That's all entirely doable, and the reason it hasn't been done is more than anything else, because the North Koreans have been dragging their feet on doing that, because their whole mythology of the Kim regime is that they descended from, I forget what mountain it is, essentially
I don't know how to pronounce it,
from heaven. They've got the mandate of heaven in the sort of Confucian sense to rule. So I think that I think Mark's exactly right. The U.S. remaining there has helped to maintain the peace, and a piece of mutual recognition has been available to the North Koreans for decades. They haven't wanted it.
Yeah, I mean the regime in North Korea is like a 18th century monarchy, more than any communist system or anything else. It's all about protecting the Kim family and protecting their hold on power, and they claim a divine right to rule, and they believe that they're entitled to the entire Korean Peninsula.
Thank you both. Very stimulating discussion. John Bullock is a retired Villanova professor that gives classes at Lifelong Learning. Last semester, he concluded one of his classes by giving a 6-point solution to the Korean issue. And I thought they were interesting. I'll throw them out and you can comment. The first was, North Korea needs to be guaranteed that they are a country and preserved. Second, they're going to have their nuclear weapon. Third, they need to suspend the capability of producing more and moving some of that key equipment, like Iran did, to a third party. Fourth, they have to agree to international inspection, Fifth, the world has to come to the humanitarian aid of the people there. And number six was the world needs to open up and do trade with North Korea. So there's a plan, and I appreciate your comments on that. Not my plan. This is John's plan.
I think that's kind of in the zone of reasonable from, you know, the American point of view. The one thing that I would add is that what they should give, you know, in return would be equal recognition of South Korea. Right, you know, there has to be a normalized relationship.
I didn't go into all the details.
Between North Korea and South Korea for this work. But that's the critical one, because, you know, the North Koreans want to kind of have it left unstated that they're really the only Korea, right? You know, kind of the way the Chinese insist that they're the only China, and Taiwan, you know, isn't there, doesn't have any legitimate status at all. That's what the North Koreans want to do to South Korea, to say that it has no legitimate status. So I think it's an important alteration. That said, I think, you know, that kind of a deal is exactly what the Clinton administration was going for. And, you know, it's one of these things where we'll never know whether the reason it didn't work out was because the North Koreans weren't really sincere, or if it was because President Bush, by vehemently, you know, making clear his distrust for North Korea, scared them off and decided that he wouldn't be a legitimate interlocutor. So, you know, we don't know which one of those things it is. But, you know, I mean, that kind of idea is reasonable. The problem is that the North Koreans have never wanted to go for it because, you know, their calculations have been basically that they're better off with repeated crises, because this way they can blackmail the outside world into giving them a certain amount of aid, and they can scare the bejesus out of their own people and therefore justify the more or less totalitarian control that they have. I agree with Mark. It's not communist in any meaningful sense, but it is totalitarian in a meaningful sense. They do, you know, the regime really does control you know, everything that happens in society. You all know how many radio stations there are in North Korea? One. Yeah, there's one.
Right. And, you know, I think that I agree with Stuart. It sounds like a good scenario and one that I would endorse. But I think the problem, as Stuart has said, would be North Korea, getting them to go along with it. And there's also a moral issue here that would be problematic for the rest of the world, because the more aid that flows in under any circumstances to Pyongyang props up this terrible regime, which imprisons millions of people, which, you know, the people of North Korea are essentially enslaved by this regime. And it seems to me there's a kind of responsibility that the world has to discourage such a regime from continuing. It's limited what we can do to stop them from flourishing. But I think sending lots of aid and helping, you know, set that country up on its feet is propping up a perfectly horrible situation.
All right, so I have a quick question. Since we can't really, like, go and, like, help the North Korean people in any way, because that would start, like, a type of war or anything like that, isn't the best solution to, like, respect North Korea's, like, authority over their people for us to pull out and, not necessarily pull out, but for us to, like, almost ignore what's really happening, and then since everybody's, like, guns are pointed at each other, why don't we just, like, leave the situation alone? Because, like, that's, like, the only thing we can really do at this point, because any type of action will result in World War III in a sense.
Right. And I think, in a way, that's what the Obama administration tried to do. President Obama decided to take a step back from the Korean problem and essentially leave them to their own devices in North Korea because of the lack of any real alternatives. And his sense of the situation was that the steps that the United States was taking was feeding this charm threat cycle, which was really not getting anywhere, and was benefiting North Korea more than it was anyone else. I think that the administration of President Trump has thrown some gasoline on the problem. Like it or not, the American people elected him through the Electoral College anyway, to be president of the United States, and we have to deal with the issues that he chooses to focus on. And this, for worse, I think, is one that he has chosen to make a priority.
Hi, I just had a couple of questions. One, I know, you know, the U.S. military has gone over this, you know, millions more times than anyone could have really have on their own. But is there any sort of, you know, conceivable military option in which it's not necessarily an all-out, you know, massive force, but something that is decapitory in a sense, but at, you know, at the same time, it's decapitory where it just causes mass confusion for at least a time where we can take out what's on the border, because that's the ultimate concern for Seoul, take out the artillery on the border. And then, you know, I'm not sure what happens after that. Maybe you give the state to China. China has to run it. It's some sort of different, you know, because they want their buffer state. I understand that. But, you know, at the same time, this is obviously not what they envisioned when they, you know, created the buffer state. And secondly, regarding the Kim-Trump summit, does any part of you concern just with, you know, the nature of it, how random it was, it sort of popped out of nowhere, and the security of you know, we're going to have the Secretary of State and the President, you know, theoretically in the DMZ, on the DMZ. Does any part of that concern you at all?
So, excellent questions. I've got a couple of thoughts on them. I mean, the short answer to your first question is no, absolutely not. There is no good military option, as Mark made clear.
And I'll explain in a little more depth than Stuart wants me to.
But strategically, the way to think about any kind of military action, any kind of military action, is that whether a military action is successful or not has nothing to do with what we do. It has to do with what the other side's reaction to it is, right? The enemy always gets a move. The problem is that, you know, the enemy has enough assets, you know, of all kinds, conventional weapons, chemical weapons, nuclear weapons, conventional artillery, missiles, short-range rockets, you know, the whole gamut. There's simply no way to take out all of that stuff quickly. And in fact, if I'm an Air Force planner thinking about how would I do this, I would say, all right, well, for a massive campaign like this, the first thing I have to do is take out their air defenses. Well, the minute North Korea sees the U.S. taking out their air defenses, they know that something very big is coming, and they're going to react immediately.
Yeah, and you have to understand this is a very crisis-focused regime whose whole point of building all these weapons is to protect the Kim dynasty. So however we perceive our military action, whether we perceive it as a limited strike, as a something that's, as you point out, going to create confusion, it's long enough for us to take out the conventional weapons on the DMZ, north of the DMZ, they're going to perceive it, as Stuart says, as a existential threat, and they're going to react accordingly. And in a normal world where there were conventional weapons, that might be an acceptable risk. But the whole point of weapons of mass destruction is that it's not, you can't think of them in this way, because the use of a chemical or biological weapon that would kill literally millions of people is just unthinkable. This is why, since the beginning of the Cold War, the emphasis throughout the world has been toward preventing the use of nuclear weapons. Trump is really the first American president we've had who seems to be kind of thrilled at the idea of maybe shooting off a nuke, you know? And we should all live in fear. And I think, in fact, we've seen that the military advisors around him in the Pentagon have acted as a restraining force. And what was the second part of your question?
Does any part of the Trump-Kim summit concern you directly? Because no. To me, like, the idea of the president and the secretary of state being on the DMZ, the idea of the securing that, I'm sure, for the Secret Service and the military is a nightmare. But does that, I mean, that's very concerning to me, you know.
I'm not concerned about it. I think that we have, you know, for a summit meeting like that, the security precautions that would be taken, I presume, would be adequate. And there would be absolutely no goal that North Korea would achieve by attacking the Secretary of State or the President of the United States. It's not like they're irreplaceable. I mean, in their own regime, you know, Kim is far more important, frankly, than the President of the United States is. And we have a line of succession, and the government would still function, and there would be a hell of a price to pay for doing that. Sadly, I think, for more than just North Korea.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's interesting. The first part of your question was, isn't it sort of random that this idea popped out of nowhere? And I agree completely. That's why I said, the chance that anything good could come out of it is very small, because they haven't had the time to do the pre-negotiations. Normally, when a summit is going to succeed, the way you do it is lower-level officials negotiate out all the details, and the presidents just kind of shake hands, smile, and sign. Since in this case they will not have had the opportunity to do that, that's exactly why I think it's likely to go bad. It's so random that you and I have made completely opposite assumptions about where it's likely to be. Right? You're assuming it's going to be at Panmunjom, in the demilitarized zone. I'm assuming, for exactly the reasons that you outlined, if I was running, State Department security, I wouldn't put it there. I'd say, let's meet in Beijing. Right? Yeah, it gives the Chinese some credibility and some stature, but that's fine. It's much safer in Beijing. One last point, though, the most optimistic thing I have to say about this is that I think the way President Trump handled the most recent set of strikes in Syria is very heartening. The fact of the matter is it didn't accomplish much. It accomplished a little bit. The U.S. had been saying don't use chemical weapons or else, and they used chemical weapons actually numerous times, not just once. And so the U.S. responded by attacking the chemical weapons facilities that Syria was maintaining.
With Britain and France.
With Britain and France. It was done in a multilateral way. It was done in a measured way. It was done in a way where escalation was very unlikely. When President Trump went on TV to talk about it, he stuck to his talking points. He read what was on the teleprompter instead going off, randomly. If he can kind of stay on message in that way in regard to North Korea, then I think there's an excellent chance we'd get out of this without without things going seriously badly. But from that point of view, my hope would be honestly that both sides agree to disagree on something like where are we going to meet. And therefore, the summit never happens. I think that we'd actually be better off that way.
Well, I actually disagree with the idea that this has come up kind of randomly. It has from our perspective, from an American perspective. But I think this is a very deliberate step by the regime in Pyongyang. I think that there have been, correct me if I'm wrong, they've been offering, Kim Jong-un has been offering to sit down with Obama for years. He's wanted a meeting like this for years. He's playing Trump. I mean, Trump is a sucker for the dramatic, grand gesture in a way that Obama never was. And so I think, the charm offensive during the Olympics, the meeting with the South Korean regime, the trip to China, it's all part of a very well orchestrated plan for Pyongyang to, I think, set up, and I think Trump has fallen happily into the lap of Kim Jong-un in this.
So first of all, the kind of decapitory measure he suggested, the first thing I thought of from that was actually not like conventional military move, but more of like a cyber attack or something like that. So I was curious what your thoughts were on given that they're not as technologically developed, would like debilitate their communications or their ability to coordinate some kind of defense, would be able to accomplish anything. And also just when you were mentioning perspectives reminded me of, I don't know how much is available about this, but what exactly the perspective is within North Korea domestically and what kind of story they're being fed by the regime about what's going on with these summits and how much that differs from what we're being told here.
A lot. I think that the lack of technological sophistication in North Korea While you might think, oh, gee, then it'll be easy for us to sort of take out their computers, I would say it actually works to their benefit because you can take out their computers, but you haven't slowed them down a bit. It's kind of like during the Vietnam War when you know, people kept calling for the United States to bomb the hell out of Hanoi and to drop more bombs, and these aviators would come back and say, what are we, you know, I'm risking my life to bomb a wooden bridge that can be rebuilt tomorrow, which is what they were doing. And so I think, you know, a cyber attack on North Korea would have only limited, unlike a highly developed industrialized society, unlike, say, for instance, Seoul, which could really be damaged by a cyber attack, I don't think we could make much of a dent in North Korea. And what was the second part?
Just about if there's any information available.
Oh, yeah. What's it? Well, I haven't read it, but I mean, I've read enough about the propaganda narrative in North Korea to say that any threatening behavior by the United States toward North Korea is just seen as a proof of what the regime has been preaching for generations, which is that the United States is the enemy. The United States is about to attack. That's why we need this huge military. That's why we need these nuclear arms.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm about to say is completely inaccurate, but I think it presents an image that might be useful for you. Did you ever play with two tin cans attached by a string and use that as a telephone when you were a kid, right? I mean, you should really think of you know, North Korean communications technology in that sense, right? A cyber attack isn't going to make any difference. I mean, literally, that's untrue, but you know, as an image, that's the way to think about it. And so, you know. You know, getting involved in a cyber war with North Korea is a totally one-sided thing because the U.S. and its allies are vulnerable to that sort of thing because we depend on our high-tech society. They don't have one. So
they're... Did you see Battlestar Galactica? The whole premise of Battlestar Galactica is all the ships in the Starfleet are destroyed by this sophisticated computer attack, except for one, because they have this very old-fashioned admiral who insists on using, you know, wire-linked phones, and they're the one starship that doesn't get destroyed. That's North Korea.
Hi. So, a lot of people, including I think Professor Kaufman, are concerned with the negotiation going badly. I am frankly concerned that the negotiation might have a different scenario where Trump agrees to something without understanding what it means. Uh-huh. And so the other day I was listening to an expert who was explaining what the word denuclearization means. So to the Americans and South Koreans, denuclearization means the removal of the North Korean nuclear program. To the North Koreans, denuclearization means the removal of extended deterrence by the Americans to South Koreans, mm-hmm. and possibly the removal of conventional American forces from the Korean Peninsula.
Exactly. And I think that's what Kim Jong-un is after.
Right? Yeah. And so what happens if, you know, during the negotiations, the president's words actually count and are taken at face value, is my...
Well, I think that the laugh you got there is really the answer. But literally, in a, sort of in a diplomatic sense, what happens in a case like that, if you know President Trump does fall into a stupid trap like that and agree, oh yeah, that's great, denuclearize, yeah, we're all for it, that's awesome. You know, what'll come back is the State Department will then write up our understanding of what denuclearization means. And then the North Korea will say, no, that's not what we had in mind at all, right? So it would fall through. So actually, that doesn't worry me too much.
There would have to be some kind of congressional approval, too, wouldn't there?
Right, but it wouldn't even get to that stage.
He doesn't have a completely free hand in these negotiations, either.
I may take advantage. Well, maybe not the last question, but I do want to ask a quick question. Right. As I said, Mark would always come to class whenever I said, would you talk to my class? And so in advance of his coming last semester, was it? Last year, I had the students read his four options to dealing with North Korea. Out of 60 students, a plurality chose the one that had the most fatalities. Let's wipe them out. Let's get serious about this. So part of it may be you.
The most casualties.
Yes. That if we're going to do it, you might as well do it right and hang the number of dead. So and part of that could be youth. Part of it could also be, and I'm almost more interested in Stuart's answer on this, As much as I hate using the word news media as a monolithic thing, how are we doing in terms of educating the American public on what's going on and what the stakes are?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I can't decide. Well, so let me take a step back and say the first thing I tell my students about any great national security problem is that typically you have three policy options for dealing with a crisis of some kind: bad, worse, and truly awful. Right, and the hard part is figuring out which option is going to get to which outcome. I think of that only because I'm trying to think of how to characterize how the media is doing, and it's between bad, worse, and truly awful. The media isn't really built to get across complicated things of any kind. For people who look for it, you can find stuff like Mark's piece in The Atlantic, for example, which I assign to my students too. That's really first-rate reporting, no academic has improved on, because it's up to date in a way academic can never be. And you talk to all the academics who know this stuff, the media isn't really built to do that. But I think there's a piece of what the media isn't built to do that's even more fundamental and more important, which is that editors seem to feel that there's a kind of narrative about whatever's going on that their story has to fit into. And so it just runs too much against the grain, for example, to run a story that says Kim Jong-un isn't crazy. He's very smart, he's very shrewd, he knows exactly what he's doing, and he doesn't want to die. You never hear that because the mindset of the editors is that's not the narrative, so I can't say it. So I think the fundamental problem with the media is that there's this sort of common wisdom that they feel like they have to say, rather than paying more serious attention to the facts, frankly.
Mark, what do you think? The media is a big word. And
this is the mainstream media, is what I mean, including
right.
The Fox News types.
And, I think there is good reporting and very detailed analyses out there. You don't get it from television. I've told my children, I tell everybody I can talk to about this, all my students, stop watching television. Get your news from newspapers. Read them online if you prefer to read them on a laptop. But I spend an hour and a half in the morning reading the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, because it pisses me off, and the Philadelphia Inquirer because of the sports. And I spend that hour and a half, and I feel like I am fully informed about what's going on in the world, better than most people. And I never watch television. I never watch any of these dramas that are playing out on constant. Basically what it is in most cases, it's a group of people who have no idea what they're talking about, sitting around, arguing endlessly about things that everyone will forget, the next day. So just don't, it's bad for your mental health. That's what I think.
I'd like to follow up on that, though. I remember one time, I looked at kind of what the New York Times international coverage was for a day, and it was all obsessed. I forget exactly. It was probably something with some sort of relatively trivial issue going on in Israel, and then I did a broader search of the internet looking for international media sources on what's been going on in the last 24 hours. What else might the New York Times have reported? And there was a huge list of stuff. Elections in one country, riots in another, all kinds of phenomenally important events that doesn't even make it in the New York Times. So a lot of the questions that are coming up tonight are things that responsible media would have reported about North Korea. But Mark is right. On TV, it's just, let's pick the stupidest possible question, is Secretary of Defense Mattis overrated, right? So make it a completely meaningless question and then argue about it for an hour. So, absolutely. TV news is completely worthless. Don't watch. But the print media, while it's better, is still far, far short of actually providing the information that you need. Now, there are good reasons for that. Now, the reasons in the past were not as compelling because they used to have the resources to do good journalism, and they just chose to do less of it than they could have. Now they don't have the resources, so it's harder because now it depends on you need clickbait, right? And of course it's always if you have a choice between reading about the latest on the North Korean nuclear crisis or Lady Gaga, I mean what people are going to click on. I was going to say the Kardashians. I thought that was maybe a little passé. Am I wrong? No, the Kardashians are still kind of it, huh? Yeah, that's even worse, right? Because at least Lady Gaga has a talent.
Okay, so not going into a whole course on news media economics. Last question.
Where do you think the Russians are on this?
I think at this point, Vladimir Putin is probably thrilled with anything that's causing real headaches for the United States. And so I would not look for any real help from Russia in dealing with North Korea. I think they're one of the countries that still trades with North Korea. There's a lot of sanctions that are being enforced to prevent fuel oil and other supplies from going as a punishment to the Pyongyang regime. And I think that Russia is one of the countries that's still supplying them with things.
Yeah, the only good news there is that Putin is like Trump, very transactional, and so the limits on the amount of trade that North Korea and Russia can do are based on the fact that North Korea can't afford to pay for it, and Putin is interested. He doesn't want to sell his oil for nothing. It seems to me this is one where Mark is absolutely right. Putin's not going to help, but I don't think he's going to do much to hurt either. He's put his chips in other pots, that's where he's causing this trouble in Ukraine and Syria and places like that. I think he's happy to see lots of trouble as long as it doesn't involve radioactive material drifting over Siberia.
Guys, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.